listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
It's Rob from the Football in Europe podcast. Every Monday we bring you a brand new show on Audio Boom and iTunes, detailing the latest news in Germany, Spain, France, Italy and more. But this is a bonus feature, an extended interview with the German football journalist Raphael Honigstein. It's in relation to his brand new book, Das Reboot, about how German football reinvented itself and how Germany won the World Cup in 2014. And I started by asking Raphael about when was the starting point, because many people talk about Euro 2000 being the starting point for German football taking a good hard look at itself, but it seems the changes were being made slightly before that.
One of the things that surprised me was that by 98, there were already reforms afoot. Now, they hadn't really been perhaps supported very well. They'd been completely off the radar as far as public perception was concerned. But things had already started moving in the right direction at grassroots level. I think what Euro 2000 then does is it sharpens everybody's mind to just how big the task is. It makes it easier to get real commitment beyond the letter of the law from the clubs to say, okay, we will invest in youth development. And it also adds to the sense that with the World Cup in Germany around the corner in 2006, we need to start sorting things out. So I think the turning point, as it was, is World Cup 98, but things turned slowly and it picked up a lot more pace after Euro 2000 and then again, I think, after Euro 2004.
Quite often in these tales of restructuring of sport, it is young, dynamic, outside of the sport figures who can often change things. And in a sense, the coaches you talk about later in the book, like Klopp and Klinsmann, would come into that category. But looking at people like Dietrich Weiser, I mean, these were people, and Bertie Vogts, who perhaps spotted part of the problem. These were older figureheads, if you like, in the game who helped instigate that change. I find that interesting.
Yes, so did I. And Dietrich Weiser is one of the unsung heroes of this story. And people had completely forgotten about him by the time that sort of the reforms were taking shape. And I think the reason for that is that he is, you know, not a big character in terms of charisma, in terms of public stature. He's somebody who worked behind the scenes for a long, long time and never really sought the limelight either. So I think it is fitting in a way that he is now being more recognised, I think, for what he's done. And I think also the German FA have belatedly perhaps tried to show their appreciation of what he's done. Bertie Vogt is a similar case, although different in the way that he, of course, was Germany's national coach for many years, a big player as well, World Cup winner. But he was never perceived, I think, as a modernizer because as a coach, he was very conservative and perhaps part of the problem. In a deeper level, though, you know, when it comes to recognizing the real problem, i.e. the lack of talented youngsters coming through, he saw it perhaps slightly earlier than others, and I would also credit him with bringing in former players, namely from Euro 96, and making sure that they were not lost to German football. Their expertise becomes part of the setup, you know, in people like Bierhoff, in people like Köpke, Klinsmann, and I think that is a big achievement of his, that he managed to get the last generation of players who had won anything involved in the process of making Germany able to win stuff again in the future.
Well, there's a good quote actually corresponding to some of the later stuff from Ralf Rangnick when he's talking about, he says, I underestimated how sensitive people in football are to the idea of change. And it seemed like behind the scenes, while people in England viewed that the change in German football as this harmonic, everyone's worked together for the better of the national team, there was a lot of conflict behind the scenes for a lot of these changes.
Yeah, and some of it wasn't even kept behind the scenes. I mean, there was very vocal opposition to what Klinsmann and Bierhoff were doing in the first few years, simply because it was new, because they hadn't come with a big pedigree, because they were picking youngsters that nobody had heard of, like Robert Huth, for example, from Chelsea at that time. And there is this thing in football that, you know, people say, you know, who are you? unless he come with a glittering CV. Of course, Klinsmann had that, but not as a coach. And whenever things didn't go according to plan, the lack of experience was, of course, the first thing that people honed in on. And he did make mistakes. And, you know, change could have always been handled better. Bielsa said a similar thing to me. He said, you know, I also underestimated just how emotional these things are. You can have the best PowerPoint presentation in the world. If you don't actually put an arm around his shoulder, I'm paraphrasing here slightly, an arm around the guy's shoulder and explain to him that he's not going to be losing his job, that his opinion will still be valued, it all is worth nothing at all. You have to sort of take people with you on a much more visceral level. And I think Klinsmann managed to do that with the team, and Bielsa managed to do that with the FA to a certain extent after some resistance. And then I think a wider appreciation only came when the likes of Rangnick and, more importantly, Jurgen Klopp had success with their methods at club level, which then showed everybody, aha, you know, there is a new way of doing things, and perhaps isn't so stupid to look at what other countries are doing and to open ourselves up a little bit to new ideas. And I think at that point, the stage was then set for people like Van Gaal and ultimately Guardiola to come in and take German club football to a new level.
Can you explain it? And it's a bit of a complex idea, but in the book you mentioned that someone like Toni Kroos, prior to major upheavals in the system, might not have been a player that was picked up. What changes in the system had to take place for someone like Kroos, considering where he was from, to eventually become one of the world's finest midfielders?
Yeah, this is something Advisor talked about, because Toni Kroos is from a small village in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, which is the far east of Germany, really, one of the new states that became Germany after unification, so the former GDR. There is no football club anywhere around, anywhere near, would have been big enough to see him. And, you know, you can say that he was so good that eventually somebody would have found him, but right. I think the point is, from Weiser, what Weiser ensured is that players who, in the late 90s, when there's no academies, don't forget, who don't happen to have been found at 16 or 15 playing for one of the 20 top professional clubs in Germany, they have no chance of ever making it. They're just not being seen. They're being lost. And it's just a numbers game. If you are not producing enough good players, if your 20 professional clubs are not producing enough good players, chances are that they're missing out on a few. And that was Weiser's idea. So Weiser said, okay, let's have this network, quite literally a network, that can capture people who would otherwise fall through between the big teams, who just fall through the cracks. And I don't think that necessarily, looking back, it was the most important thing. I think the most important work was later done at club level. But I think it showed that the German FA were ready to invest and ready to face the problem and actually react to it, rather than say, you know what, good players will always rise to the top, we just don't do anything, etc. And at the time, I think before the clubs really got going with their academies, these regional centres become a bit of a lifeline. And for the first time, you know, people receive regular coaching. And I think it was part of the German FA professionalising its setup and making sure that, you know, the moment you have local branches, you need qualified coaches. The moment you have qualified coaches, you need to have coaches who coach the qualified coaches. So a process was set into motion where the whole idea of looking after young players, whether at club or country level, becomes more professional. And I think that's where that's Weiser's real achievement, to put Germany on the right path towards having a very comprehensive structure in place for youth development.
And I suppose part of the problem for him as well, it wasn't just ideological, it was financial, that to get clubs and the German Football Association to invest, I mean, hundreds of millions of euros that I'm you know, indirectly through transfer sales and everything and success, they've got that, they've got their money back in a sense, I suppose.
Yeah, it is. And of course, the, I mean, the German FA do not get their money back in the way because they don't, you know, own these players. But yeah, what they do get is players who can play for Germany. And the chances are that, you know, if you're at one of the regional centres, you soon become so good that a club will sign you up. So it's almost as if the German FA are working on behalf of the club in that sense. Yeah. You know, they're building, yeah, they're building the raw material that the clubs benefit from. But of course, there is also a wider benefit that they have the money and they have the players. So why not make sure that the players you do have receive the best possible training? It's a bit of a no-brainer, but I think before Weise was able to put these reforms into place, it was quite political in the sense that different regional associations wanted their players represented at national level. So you'd have somebody from Bavaria say, well, I want my two best Bavarians in the team, and then somebody from Schleswig-Holstein saying, well, what about me? I haven't got a player in. So it became sort of a horse trading thing rather than finding the best players. And the financial commitment wasn't there because it wasn't seen as a problem. You know, why do we need youth development? We have 6 million registered football players. Surely we'll find 30 decent ones who represent the international level. But I think they realized that Germany was being left behind in terms of the education that the players were coming through were neither good enough in numbers nor in quality.
Did you have a favorite? Because you interview some, I mean, the biggest names. Is there a favorite interviewee that you had from the book?
I mean, it's a dream talking to somebody like Thomas Müller because just every line is printable. And Mertens is such a smart guy that, you know, everything he says is of value. And I personally also really enjoy, for example, Rangnick, simply because the sort of historical aspect and coming from like a small provincial place and managing to sort of to change German tactics from the bottom up. I just love that story, you know, this kind of slightly nerdy crew of coaches who just get together around old VHS tapes and watch Arrigo Sacchi's Milan play and trying to figure out what they're doing.
And break the video recorder.
I kind of loved all that. But no, I mean, I'm really grateful because I think that even sort of the lesser known people like Volker Kersting at Mainz 05, you know, somebody who was or still is in charge of youth development for a number of years, was able to give a real overview of how things have progressed. And it's hard to do it without the expertise of these guys because you're just looking at numbers and can't really quite get a sense of where you are. So it was really, really beneficial, I think, to be able to talk to people who've just been doing nothing else, you know, for 25 years in this case.
Do you think one of the big successes of how the system is now is that it will guard against future complacency, that German football won't stagnate perhaps as it did, as you mentioned in the book, that they will continue to progress and the aim is to be open-minded and to stay at the top?
I mean, that is very much my sense. I mean, one of the things that surprised me was that everyone I talked to sort of almost, you know, once the tape recorder had stopped running, so took me aside and said, you know what, this is all great, but we could be doing so much better. This isn't quite right. Here we need to change. Here we need to do this better. So there is this kind of process and this mindset of sort of continual optimization and people constantly trying to make things better and to be smarter. And I think it's driven very much from the top because, you know, you could see that Germany at the World Cup maximized all their opportunities by way of bringing in technology, by way of focusing on things they hadn't done well, like dead ball situations, and they're already at the next level where they're saying, you know, we need a dedicated seminar on dead ball coach on dead ball performances and this kind of stuff. So I think there is a good reason to be optimistic that Germany will not rest on its laurels. Of course, one of the things I think they have to get right, and this is something that Thomas Tuchel talks about and Philipp Lahm in the book as well, is that you don't want to become so professional that players are sort of bred in a bubble, in a right. lab, and then cannot deal with things that are not 100% brilliant when it comes to the pitch or, you know, the changing rooms or whatever. So I think you still have to kind of keep, almost deliberately keep it less perfect than it could be, just for them to work in the field and for the things to actually work when there's resistance and opposition who don't play by the book or whatever.
I mean, Liverpool fans are already about to explode. They're so excited about Klopp. But if they read your book, I think they might be even more encouraged, because from his TV studio appearances that he made when he was at Mainz to his eventual successes at Dortmund, I mean, he's part of that generation of coaches who gegenpressing and this kind of thing, this kind of brand of football that is so important to German football now.
Yeah, I think he was absolutely influential in changing the way that Bundesliga football now is being played. I think it's almost become the norm that teams press really high, try to win the ball back as quickly as possible, try to be as quick as they can in transition. You know, he didn't invent that, but from the success of his system and his methods, people have adopted that wholesale. And I think it's sort of shown that, yes, of course, you still need to have the good players, and better players are more likely to win your games, but a lot of your disadvantages can be hidden if your system works really well. And, you know, I took Dortmund within a breath of winning the Champions League, and they won two titles and a cup. And I think that is something that will excite everybody, because it kind of it goes beyond this idea that, you know, we just have to sign all these fantastic, brilliant players and then we can compete. So, no, he'll tell you, yes, of course, great players make it easier for me as a coach, but there's actually a lot that can be done if you work together. If you work a bit harder than your position, if you're a bit smarter with your resources. So in that sense, I think everybody in Germany feels that he is a great manager for a club like Liverpool, who's just waiting to have a sense of purpose and have a sense of direction. I think he will bring that. So I am convinced that he will be a success. How big a success, I'm not sure. I don't think anybody knows. But I think he will change the way that Liverpool Football Club will feel about itself. And I think he'll bring a real sense of optimism. And I think that's already half the job done.
And bizarrely, we've talked for about 15 minutes about your book and not really talked about the actual process of winning the World Cup, which is almost the backbone of the whole book. You know, what are your thoughts now on that campaign? Because in my head, it was a smooth... Of course Germany won it, but there was the mad Algeria game, there was the nerves ahead of the France game, a little bit of criticism. It wasn't quite as plain sailing as I seem to remember.
No, it never really isn't. I was thinking about this just the other day, because Germany have now qualified for the Euros and they haven't really done so in a convincing fashion, and almost it feels in Germany as if, you know, we got no chance of winning the Euros now. I mean, that is sort of the pessimism that's crept back in. And in a way, Germany going to every single tournament in that sense, that you look at your own faults and they're magnified and everybody else looks really good. And then you get to the tournament and look around and see that, you know, everybody else isn't actually that good either. They have
Everyone's
their own problems.
It's
just about minimizing your own problems. And Germany managed to do this. I mean, they didn't really have any fullbacks. They didn't really have any fit holding midfielder, but they kind of came through and managed to find solutions for that. And now we almost have the same story again. You know, no real defensive midfielder, or at least no one who's playing regularly there in a position, and no fullback. Now that Philipp Lahm's gone, the problem's even bigger. So it's always the same in a way. But I guess that is part of Germany's success story, that they are obsessed with their own problems. But that also takes them to the point where they will try everything as much as they can to negate these problems. And if the last tournaments are anything to go by, it's probably not the worst mindset to get into a big competition.
You've been listening to Football in Europe. Join us every week on Audio Boom for the latest content, interviews and special features. For more, follow at FAE Show on Twitter or head to footballineurope.co.uk.